Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
Hello, welcome back to the show. Hey, Dad, how you doing?
Hello, Tay. Good. How are you doing?
Oh, just fine. Sweaty.
Just fine.
So, how's that?
We're having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave.
Not in a good way, though.
No, it's not a good heat wave. It's just hot. Damn hot.
Did you have anything good to drink this week to counteract all of this heat?
Well, not as much as I would have liked to, but I did have one that was very interesting that if it wasn't for an episode that we had done, I probably wouldn't have even tried it. We went to Bonhof. You're familiar with Bonhof. And they had a beer on tap that was a Brazilian lemonade gosa. Now, nice. Normally I wouldn't have had it because it was a gosa, but I got it, and it was surprisingly good. It had just the right amount of, citrus, but it followed up with that salt taste on the end, and it made it really interesting, and it was very light and refreshing.
Nice. Do you remember the name?
It's okay. It was made by Sycamore.
Okay.
Was the name of the distributor or whatever, the manufacturer was Sycamore, and it was Brazilian lemonade gosa.
Sounds nice. Sounds good for a hot day.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. But I would not have even tried a gosa if it hadn't been for when we talked about them and we tried those ones.
Good for you for branching out and trying something
new. Expanded my palate.
You're rewarded with a good experience. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, that was pretty good. I'd get that again if they had it.
Yeah, gosa is a good... I feel like for heat, it's kind of designed for that. It's citrusy. It's a little salty. Sometimes, depending on what you buy, sometimes spices involved. There's a lot that goes on that complements horrible temperatures.
Riley has found that she kind of likes gosas sometimes, too. She's tried a couple since we've talked about them, and she's a little bit interested in them, too. What about you? You have anything interesting?
No, I don't. I don't go. I haven't gone out this week. But I did have a few drinks. I was in. Well, okay. Sort of the premise for this episode too. I know where. I was thinking of you this week, Dad. We're gonna spend some time together in a week or so at the beach.
Wasting away again in Margaritaville.
Yeah, going to Margaritaville Beach. On display. But, I was thinking of, cocktails. I was really happy to introduce you to the Whiskey Sour because I know that's a drink you like. And you generally like whiskey drinks more than any other spirit base, I'd say. Maybe tequila is, even with that. But still, the question of beach-friendly whiskey drinks is a tough one. So I was sort of, just as a fun experiment, going through, some classic cocktails of, shaken and bright and fruity, but also happened to be whiskey, and stumbled upon a drink that I thought kind of has a cool history to it, a cool story to it that I thought we could talk about this week. So I had a few, and I thought this is enough. This is good enough that I can tell the world about it.
Well, good. I'm glad that you found it.
Yeah. Well, it's a drink called the Scofflaw. Now, have you ever heard of a Scofflaw cocktail or the word itself? You've probably heard of the word.
I've heard of the word. I've never heard of it as a cocktail, but I have heard of a Scofflaw, but in my mind, it's like 1920s movie. Yeah, get out of here. Get off the sidewalk, you Scofflaw.
that's actually fairly accurate. And I think that's the interesting thing. well, so, we know from discussions we've had in the past that Prohibition was not just this, like, end point to cocktail culture. It created a lot of weird, like, cocktails came out of Prohibition. A lot of creation happened under the limitations of Prohibition. But I think in this case, it's one of the few instances of an entire word being created because of Prohibition. And that is...
That's true.
Before we even get into the cocktail, that is the scofflaw, the name, came about during Prohibition, the word. So, in a broad sense, when we say scofflaw, we think of someone who's carelessly breaking the law, right? You're not just breaking the law, but you're doing it. You're scoffing at the law.
Yeah, you're just casual about it. You don't even care. You know the rules, and you still choose to violate them.
Right. Well, but the meaning was a little bit more specific to someone who violated the laws of Prohibition. And the reason it's so specific is because the meaning actually came before the word. So, and this is according to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. It's in the dictionary. But in 1924, there was a wealthy Massachusetts prohibitionist named Delcaver King who sponsored a contest. And this contest was held in the Boston Herald newspaper. And he wanted participants to coin an appropriate term to mean a lawless drinker. Someone who flagrantly violates the laws of Prohibition. And he put an award on this. It was a $200 reward for whoever could come up with the best term for the lawless drinker during Prohibition.
And it wasn't just $200 cash. It was $200 in gold is what he was offering.
Right, yes, yes.
Yeah. And he was, what he was trying to do is he wanted to come up with a name to shame people because he didn't like that these people, Prohibition was in effect. And there was a lot of them, ones he was dealing with were the higher class people. People that knew better, they were the higher class people, but they chose to go ahead and sneak around and have their drinks anyway. And they knew it was wrong, but they were still doing it. So he thought he could shame people into quitting by coming up with this name they would call these people. Oh, heaven forbid they call me this name that they've gotten because I'll be too embarrassed.
I think you have to try to come up with, like, less cool terms if you're going to shame people with it, because scofflaw sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
Scofflaw. Well, I scoff at that law. I'm fine with that.
Yeah, scofflaw was the winner, which, of course, is just you're scoffing at the law, so you're a scofflaw.
But there were, like, 25,000 entries. There were a ton of entries into this. And there were actually two people within those entries that came up with the same word.
Yeah.
So there was Henry Irving Dale and Kate L. Butler. Both submitted the word scofflaw as a combination of scoff, as in to mock or disregard, and, of course, law, as in a law. And they ended up splitting the $200 in gold. And the word scofflaw was minted as a term for those who were against the laws of Prohibition.
Now, I got to say that I liked a couple of the others that did not win better. They listed a couple of others that did not win. One of them was a Bolshevik, you know, like a Bolshevik, but it was a Bolshevik. And the other was a Boozocrat.
Those words were more I think those words were more evocative to me because I saw that too. And like, especially like Bolshevik, because it implies some sort of like, it's like a political spin that's almost, it's like an anti-American to be in favor of drinking, which is wild if you consider the history of American drinking.
Yeah.
Like the fact that it's not patriotic to drink bourbon. It's interesting to see that spin on that concept. It kind of gets to the underlying sort of... you know, it's interesting because actually we say that, and then, you know, when the term scofflaw had a bit of a revival in popularity during the 50s, during the Red Scare. As a way of talking about people again. So I do think there's a bit of an overlap there in trying to shame a specific type. And by then it was less of an alcohol thing and obviously more of just anyone who disregards the law. But it does still have that weird root in, like, creating shame and spin in the media.
Yeah, and I felt like a boozocrat was kind of a play on aristocrat, and so it was like you were a drunken aristocrat or something like that.
That's just an aristocrat, I think.
Hmm?
For most rich people,
oh, they're drunk anyway.
That's just you don't
on the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills or whatever.
Those are all boozycrats. I thought it was more of like a Democrat, but like booze, and it's like also same.
Well, that could be because, of course, you know, it said that, you know, Prohibition, Woodrow Wilson actually vetoed the law when Congress passed it. And then Congress got a 2/3 vote to override his veto and put it in. So maybe he was a Democrat and they were Republicans. I don't know. I don't know what political parties they all were, but that could have been that. But I took it as to be towards aristocrat was what they were combining there. So I don't know.
That's also, I think, a funny, I mean, I think both those two words you cited, both the Bolshevik term, which associates it with some sort of an anti-American ideal, which is not. Some mm-hmm. of the first people that settled America, one of the earliest industries in America was distilling, was brewing. But also, if you do take boozocrat as like only the rich people drink, like absolutely not. The poorest people in America, historically, that's been a vein of resources, of money, of monetary success, was distilling, was, you know, like moonshiners. So it is, I think that still kind of mirrors where we're at today in our political landscape. Like, we managed to make the concept of drinking in this time period, like, associate it with the upper class, associate it with like, horrible foreigners. It's like, no, this is something that poor Americans were doing for money.
Yeah.
They made it illegal. For a lot of tax reasons.
Yeah, but there was a lot of rich people that were involved in keeping it going because they didn't want to not drink. So
there were a lot of people involved with keeping it going. Not, yes, rich, yeah. but also poor.
Yeah.
Prohibition was the great leveler of classes. If you mm-hmm. were, if you wanted to
drink, it united them.
It did. It did. It meant that rich people, poor people alike, sat next to each other at bars because the one thing we had in common is, like, I think we should be allowed to do it, and it's kind of messed up that we can't.
Yeah. It was 13 years of misery.
Yes. But, all right, so we got the term. Now, in that same year that the term scofflaw was invented, in sort of, I think, a very obvious response to this, a cocktail by the name of the scofflaw was created at none other than the Harry Craddock's bar in Paris, the Harry's New York bar. So we should at some point go fully into the history of Harry Craddock. He's a fascinating figure. He's made a lot of cocktails, but he was born in the UK. He moved to America and then he moved back to Paris in response to Prohibition and ran Harry's New York bar. And a lot of people credit the creation of the scofflaw to Harry himself. It wasn't actually Harry. Harry credits a different bartender that worked for him at the time, a guy named Jock. But Harry was the first to publish it. He published it in his book, The ABCs of Cocktail. And that's where we get the first recipe for the scofflaw. And the drink was not anything wild. It was a pretty straightforward drink. I think it's a beautiful merger of sort of a European cocktail aesthetic and an American cocktail aesthetic, in that it was a whiskey-based drink, but it was modified by a dry vermouth, grenadine, which we talked about was French in origin, a little lemon juice, maybe orange bitters, maybe not. The recipe is a little bit all over the place throughout history, but those are the building blocks of it. It's got to be whiskey, it's got to be dry vermouth, it's got to be grenadine. Shaken, served up, no garnish necessary. It was a really kind of like just a beautiful, simple merriment of American whiskey and, you know, like more European aperitif as the building blocks and modifiers. However, I say that at the time, probably it was made with Canadian whiskey because, as we know, American whiskey was not being made at the time. So probably Canadian whiskey.
Right. Yeah. Well, in a way, it's kind of like a Manhattan and a whiskey sour combined.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, you know, Manhattan obviously sweet vermouth. This is dry vermouth. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I like the scofflaw because of really two reasons. One, I think it's a drink that lives or dies by the quality of the ingredients you use, and not in an expensive way.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a, if you don't use expensive whiskey, it's not good. No. Scofflaw works great with your most basic $18 bottle of rye. I prefer rye in a scofflaw, but mm-hmm. bourbon works fine too. That's what you prefer. But it's really the exterior ingredients. It's the vermouth and the grenadine that really define it. Are you using fresh, not, you know, set out and expired vermouth? Are you using fresh grenadine that's made appropriately? It's pomegranate-based syrup instead of a sherry and, you know, red dye thing
right.
in the grocery store. That's really kind of it. You know, I say this, the first time I had a scofflaw, I remember years ago, just... At the time, I was still learning how to make cocktails. A fellow bartender, we would just sort of, when it was slow, go through a classic bar book and make drinks that we weren't familiar with. And she mixed up a scofflaw. We both tried it, and we're like, that's still good. But at the time, we did not refrigerate our vermouth at this bar we worked at, and we didn't. We had store-bought grenadine, and it was not good. I've had it since then, and it's nice.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's also, it had great marketing value by the name, because who doesn't want to walk into a bar in that time period and they say the featured drink is a scofflaw and everybody instantly is in on the joke and say, I want to try that, you know?
Well, absolutely. And I do think that it's such a good, like, there's so many times like working in bars where there's a certain specific sort of like, I don't know, this rebellious attitude that comes with working, especially in America, in like the liquor industry, where there is so much like weird, like our weird Protestant roots and the shame around it, where you're kind of a bit contrarian in the fact that you work in it.
Yeah.
And that is very much the spirit of the scofflaw drink. It happened in the same year that the word was minted. Like, oh, scofflaw, it's a word for people that drink illegally. Great. We've got this fantastic drink that we are going to make inspired by it. I love that. Like, I feel like that is still the energy, the vibe of like a good bar to this day.
Yeah, it's got to be a little rebellious, and especially, you know, like the speakeasies were operating, you know, against the law. So they were all, anybody in there was being rebellious.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, even, you know, like people that, you know, that went to other countries to continue drinking, like that was... It was sort of a bit of a wink and a nod to Americans drinking in Paris because that's where you could drink.
Yeah. But, you know, in addition to those kind of things, I thought it was funny. They were going over some other stuff from the Prohibition period, and they were talking about how the pharmacies, the doctors could still prescribe alcohol, could prescribe booze that was on the list. And so the doctors and the pharmacies were filling all kinds of prescriptions. And they said that that it had doctors prescribed roughly 8 million gallons during Prohibition of alcohol.
Well, let's be real. And I feel like it's a not to get into politics of the day, and I won't, but I will say Prohibition was not about Prohibition. It was about access. When you look at who could have access to alcohol, because you have a similar thing. There are a lot of great stories about the church. Church obviously was allowed to have alcohol, wine for communion. Weird how many churches got into winemaking during Prohibition that could sell. Like, oh, no, we're not selling you wine. We're selling you the blood of Jesus. Would you like a Riesling blood of Jesus?
Yeah.
Or would you like a Cabernet blood of Jesus? Tons of alcohol was still flowing in America during Prohibition. Absolutely. It just limited the access to a lot of people that didn't have some sort of connection or some sort of leverage. That sounds like in other things that are in the news these days. But, you know, it's a bit of a tried and true, like, oh, we're up on our soapbox. Drinking is bad for you. No. Everybody that still has money and access and connections can still drink. It's just the people that don't have money and access. They're the ones who can't drink now.
Well, and then...
they get arrested for drinking.
Well, then they did say also that any individual was allowed to make up to 200 gallons of non-intoxicating cider or fruit juice at your house. And non-intoxicating was defined as 0.5% or less volume of alcohol. But they left it up to the IRS to determine if they were meeting this standard. The IRS said, We're not going to be in charge of that. We're not going to go around sampling these things to see if what where they're at with their alcohol level. So that the
and that was even encouraged by big industry. I mean, there you know there are so many documents. Like there were lots of companies that would produce like malting kits. Oh, do you want to make malt at home? Is that something you want to buy for your home? No, I want to make beer. So yeah. They'd sell you things to make beer at home, but they weren't selling you the beer itself, but we will charge you a premium to sell you the things to make it at home. And if you get caught with beer, that's on you. It's not on us. You know.
That was like one I saw for wine, and it was put out by a company called Fruit Industries Limited, and they produced like a grape concentrated brick that they called Vine Glow. And the package included a warning that said, after dissolving the brick in a gallon of water, do not place the liquid in a jug away in the cupboard for 20 days, because then it would turn to wine. So it gave you the directions of what not to do if you don't want it to turn into wine.
the legacy of Prohibition, I feel like very much is ingenuity. I feel like that's the word. Whether within the country's limits or outside of it, it inspired a lot of creation. It inspired a lot of rebellion.
A lot of scofflaws.
A lot of scofflaws. I kind of like, I don't even think like the fact that Prohibition was even implemented. It was such like, it was an idea that politicians could run on and have a moral crusade by with no intention or even really dedication to implementing it. Once again, which I think is interesting, especially concurrent with today's politics. It was just a talking point. It was just a moral high ground that you could take against the other opposing political party. This was so, you know. And it didn't work. It didn't work, you know. It caused a lot of people to think outside of the box. It caused a lot of people to flee the country and seek drinking elsewhere, set up shop elsewhere.
Found
new ways.
It caused organized crime to grow.
Yeah, well, you know. So it is, I love the spirit of the scofflaw. And I mean, I think the drink itself is actually really great. You know, back to the original idea, if you want like a shaken, bright, refreshing whiskey drink, but if you don't love things that are too sweet, but you don't want like a heavy stirred drink, this is a great drink for that.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're using good grenadine, especially if you're using fresh, good vermouth. It's a great drink. But I love the history. I love the spirit. The entity behind the scofflaw, I think, is almost more inspirational than the drink itself.
Yeah, that is pretty neat, and I'll hope that we can throw a couple of those together at the Margaritaville Beach.
We'll see. If you're curious at home, if you want to try it out, I would recommend it to any. If you like a whiskey sour, or even if you like a whiskey sour but you think it's a little too sweet for you, if you like a little drier, if you like, you know, boozier drinks, but you want something refreshing, you want something thirst-quenching on a hot day, it's great for that. It's not too sweet, it's not cloying, it's not going to get kind of gross as it warms up in your glass. It's a really beautiful drink, and it's tied to a ton of great, not even, this is an American history at this point, this is world history.
Mm-hmm. So you go walking in the room with one of those and tell everybody, hey, guess what I am? And then they won't know. You say, I'm a scofflaw.
I fully endorse everybody being scofflaws. We should bring the term back and embrace it.
Yeah, I think too.
And the drink too.
Now, I have to admit, I made a mistake when I was first getting ready for my research for this. I was going from memory where you had given me the topic, and I didn't look back to see it. I was thinking, what did Taylor tell me? What did Taylor say? It was some kind of a cocktail. Oh, yeah, it started with a scuh, and I came up with scallywag. And so I first looked up the scallywag cocktail, and I was like, there's no story, but there is a scallywag cocktail. And then I went back and looked at my text. Oh, a scofflaw cocktail.
What's a scallywag? I've never heard of that.
Well, it's a real cocktail, apparently, because it came right up. It's made with white rum, elderflower liqueur, fresh lime juice. Yeah, it's rum. Fresh lime juice, splash of simple syrup, 2 ounces of club soda, and a dash of Angostura bitters.
Oh, that sounds nice.
And it's a, it looks like a bright, refreshing drink. You know, yeah, they've got a slice of lime in there for the garnish.
Well, I, whether you're a scofflaw or a scallywag, there's a drink for you.
But I looked that up. The scallywag cocktail. I said, there's no story here. What's the story?
Sounds good.
I didn't expect that.
Well, if you want to make a scallywag, there you go. Dad just gave you the specs. If you want to make a scofflaw, I also encourage you to. It's a great, if you're a whiskey fan, make one. But rules of the game, you gotta get those tiny bottles of vermouth. Get the little ones. You know, you can drink them before they go bad. Keep them in your fridge. Keep your vermouth in your fridge. Always, always. First rule of bartending. That's not really the first rule of bartending, but it's my first rule of bartending. Keep your vermouth in your fridge. Second rule of this cocktail, at least, is make your grenadine fresh. There are a lot of recipes for grenadine out there, and even if you make the most simple, time-friendly, cheapest version of homemade grenadine, it will be better than what you buy in the store. So make your grenadine fresh. You know, a lot of them will bring in other ingredients, pomegranate molasses, orange blossom water. Those are great elements to a good grenadine. But honestly, if you're on a budget, you can get some pomegranate juice, some white sugar, squeeze some orange zest in there, and you'll get a serviceable grenadine that'll be 1,000 times better than the one you buy in the bottle at the store.
With red food dye number 12 or whatever it is.
And cherry. It's cherry flavored too. It's like it's just sweet red. And that's fine. Like, look, I love sweet red in certain place and time, but not in these cocktails. This is a drink. And I mean, not to nerd out, but when you look at the balance of the drink, you need the real grenadine in there because good dry vermouth is like a bright fruit, a little bit of a spice. That rye has like an earthy spice. Your grenadine has that tart pomegranate, a little bit of floral quality. These flavors all marry nice to each other. Like weird artificial cherry, like turned vinegary over like exposed vermouth. Those mm-hmm. flavors don't marry with nice rye.
Yeah. That's the difference between the 80s cocktails that I used to get that were like pre-batched as opposed to mixing up a good fresh cocktail.
Yeah. Well, and I'm a big like, spend money on your modifiers, save money on your base spirit.
Sure.
Get a bottle of Old Overhaul for $18-$20.
Mm-hmm.
Totally fine.
Yeah.
Great for this drink, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to do bourbon, get some Four Roses. Fine for this drink. Won't cost mm-hmm. you more than a 20. Spend money on your modifiers because those are the things that are going to make or break you.
Yep, I agree. I agree. The fresh ingredients make it so much better.
Yeah. And lemon or lime. There seems to be a debate on if it was lemon or lime. Lemon makes more sense to me, but I've seen a lot of like modern bartenders switch it to lime. I think that's up to you. I don't have a strong opinion on that. Somebody yeah. does. Not me.
If you're going to be a scofflaw, be a fresh one.
Hey, if you're a scofflaw, don't worry about my opinions. Make the drink however the hell you want. All right. Well, hey, thank you, Dad, as always, for being here.
Well, thank you, Tay, for having me. I learned something every day, and then also learned an additional thing there. I learned about a scallywag as well.
And we learned a word, another word, and a drink. And another drink. Thank you, listeners, for joining us. Of course, thank you to our Patreon members. You are the reason this happens. Rewards are coming out this week, so keep an eye on your mail for those. If you have not updated your address recently, you can do that. Just let me know. I have extras. But if you want to know more about that, you want to support us, you should check out our Patreon. If you want to find us on social media, we are Neat Boozecast on Twitter and Instagram, and we are neattheboozecast@gmail.com if you'd like to hit us up with some questions. And if you'd like to talk about scofflaws and scallywags, you can do that.
At Neat the Boozecast group page on Facebook.
Go there, do that.
Yeah.
Break the law. Not the Facebook laws, you'll get banned if you do that.
Or yeah, we... We had someone demonstrate their homemade coffee liqueur recipe that they made. So that looked pretty good. Yeah.
All right, y'all. Happy drinking. I have been Taylor Swirl.
I've been Tommy Swirl.
And this has been...
me. Full of scallywags and scofflaws.
I think I want to embrace the bamboo.
Yeah, whoever picked that one got railroaded out of a $200.
Like, I believe in shared resources and alcohol.
Hit me up with a drink, comrade.
That's not your cocktail. That's our cocktail.
That's right. The people's cocktail.